behind the silence of a great stone wall. The howling of a new wilderness, beyond the distance of a great stone wall. It will change, it will change. It wasn't always like this.
We got a message from Bono sent to us today, and just a piece from it says, how can the poorest countries earn their way out of poverty when we don't allow them access to our markets, but we can flood theirs? Trade reform isn't about charity, it's about justice. Trade Justice Ireland have an unstoppable idea.
Way on the other side of that storm cloud wall, dancing in the clear blue sky, behind the silence of a great stone wall.
Mary Breach, and I live in Sneem, County Kerry, and because I've been at a lot of the peace demonstrations during the past few months, I picked up a leaflet about today, and I said I'm definitely going to that, because I feel that the big thing that the past few months has brought home to me is the fact that ordinary people have tremendous power, enormous power, and they're not aware of it. And I think we're approaching a time when people power is really going to come into its own, and people are going to say, I want to reclaim the media and reclaim my government so that they really represent me and humanity as a whole. This came up with a group of us recently, and we're planning to become more active.
Trade justice now!
I think they should have heard.
So look out, Michael Healy Ray. Jackie Healy Ray, John O'Donoghue.
Thank you.
In the hours that followed, more than a third of TDs in the Dáil were personally lobbied by hundreds of their constituents. Trade Justice Ireland had prepared a series of demands around the injustices and the lack of democracy in the rules of international trade and the WTO. Included was the demand that Ireland, in the Cancun Ministerial, stop supporting the EU position of aggressively pushing for developing countries to accept the launch of a round of trade agreements that will further disadvantage them. For the remainder of the afternoon, the Irish public ensured that their elected representatives know the score as the Cancun negotiations approach.
Yeah, my name is John Gormley. I'm the Green Party TD for Dublin South East. I know from my own experience that most members of the Dáil are really uninformed about these issues. And, you know, you can't blame them entirely. They're extremely busy, got hectic schedules. And for them to take in all of this information is difficult. But the way that you have packaged it here made it easy to understand. The way that you've been quite friendly and open about it, and you're sitting the TDs down and informing them in this way, I think is marvellous, and you will see the effect of that.
My name is Maureen O'Connell, I'm a presentation sister, and I have just met my Fianna Fáil TD from Naois Shoghly, John Maloney, and he's actually promised to meet Michael Ahern and trying to get an annual report on how Ireland conducts itself at trade venues like the EU and World Trade Organization, and he also said he'd contact him and see about having a Dáil debate before he goes to Mexico.
And already we've seen a success, because my colleague here, Dan Boyle, who's our whip, has just informed us that we're going to get a debate now, and that again is very significant progress. And I remember 5 years ago when I was trying to get a debate on a similar issue, we had no success. So you can see that you have made a difference here.
I'm Liz McManus, Deputy Leader of the Labour Party. We will be very supportive of the aims of this campaign. So I think it is important that in relation to world trade, we put forward the arguments to ensure that there is the principle of solidarity, and that we resist the kind of neoliberal approach of the PDs in particular, who see the free market and open market as being something that is of an ideological basis that they want to promote. The reality is that poor countries simply cannot compete with highly developed countries, richer countries of the world, and that reality has to be recognised and brought home to the government.
We want to see development. We want to see these export subsidies being got rid of, because of the devastating effect that they're having in Malawi, which you've just mentioned, for example. And we just want, I mean, in a word, we just want fairness and equality. And at the moment, you don't get that because the WTO is setting the agenda, and the agenda is being set for the most powerful and the most wealthy. And that's giving rise to an unfair world. You know, I think that over a period of time, as people become more aware of the issues, that we can make an impact.
Meanwhile, in Mexico, all conditions are in place for another Seattle. And I would know the way that the water fish swim. The majority of developing countries remain united against the new round. The US and the EU are again squabbling as they were in Seattle. And Mexican civil society is preparing a massive welcome for the WTO in the streets of Cancun.
We're waiting for the outcome to show and the endings to be released.
The struggle against the Cancun ministerial is being really started to build on social movements, emerging of the indigenous and peasant communities in southern Mexico.
It will change, it will change. It wasn't always like this.
Many NGOs in Mexico are really following what these peasant organizations are really planning.
These are the words of campaigner Manuel Perez Rocha, who works with many of the people in Mexico who suffer the most from trade injustices. People on the other end of the WTO. And of course there are alternatives, he says, and people in Europe wishing to support the struggle of the marginalized in developing countries by campaigning for trade justice need not look far for ideas.
So what I think it should work on a north-south basis is many principles in the European Union, no? Like a basic charter of workers' rights. There should be one. There is no reason why European companies should delocalize its production from Europe to other countries where they can benefit from very poor living conditions, environmental and wages and all that. Another thing, for example, is the concept of subsidiarity. It's a concept within Europe that says that every decision should be taken at its lowest possible level of government, which of course is very contradictory with the way also the European Union is grasping powers from the countries, no? But the concept is there. It is lying in the founding principles of the European Union. So many things like democracy, decentralization, human rights, civil society participation, social dialogue, many things that are in the European Union charters of principles. Then I think there should be a condition for other trade agreements the European Union carries out with other countries in the South.
But if there is to be justice for the marginalized in Mexico, people in Europe have a role to play.
What I think would be important is see how to support these social organizations into the struggle, see how to support them, but above all, make governments understand that the struggle is not only in Cancun, but it's all in all the world. I think it's very important that simultaneously to Cancun, there must be struggle demonstrations and campaigns constantly and simultaneously elsewhere.
This September, as the struggle for trade justice rages on the streets and inside the ministerial of Cancun, through an international day of action, people demanding trade justice will again raise their voices, echoing the cries that will be coming out of Mexico.
Go to your Ministry of Foreign Affairs or the Ministry of Trade as well and make a huge demonstration against the WTO on the days of the ministerial in Cancun. That will be the best support that you can give to people fighting and struggling in Cancun.
In Ireland, the Trade Justice Ireland Coalition will host the Unfair Games. Well, they tell me there's light at the end. In solidarity with the poor and the marginalized demanding a better deal in Cancun, these games will viscerally demonstrate the absurd disadvantages which one side would suffer if the rules of international trade were applied to sport. Other groups are also planning actions. Within the ever-growing movement for trade justice, all eyes will be on Cancun. People will be watching events on the streets and in the ministerial, and they will be watching how their governments will behave
behind the silence of the great stone wall,
in a world crying out for justice.
Beyond the distance of a great stone wall, it will change, it will change. It wasn't always like this.
has been a Kolob Media production. Music courtesy of Jim Page and Keela. Interview with anonymous trade diplomat read by George B. Saremba. And quoted from Power Politics of the WTO by Eileen Kwa. Narration by Donica O'Brien. Written and produced by Ian MacDonald. For more information on the Movement for Trade Justice in Ireland, see www.tradejusticeireland.org.
You've been listening to A People's History of the WTO, a recent documentary written and produced in Ireland by Ian MacDonald. Feminist author Starhawk has been an activist since the 1960s. She's worked for peace, equality for women, in defense of the environment, and more recently as an opponent of corporate globalization. She sees these various areas as part of one larger question, re-envisioning human society and changing our relationships to each other and to the natural world. She spoke with Danielle Hickey from the front lines of the protest in Cancun this weekend about the week's events and their connection to the future.
I'm talking to Starhawk. Starhawk, can you tell me what you're seeing?
I'm seeing a lot of people coming up to the barrier that the police and government have erected across the road to the hotel zone. And there are some talk about a plan to basically firmly but peacefully dismantle it. Not so much because people want to think they can march all the way out to the conference center, but as a symbol that barriers can't keep us out and there should be no barriers against people as long as there are no barriers to corporations and profits.
I see. And who are you here with?
I'm here with a group called RANT, the Root Activist Network of Trainers, and we do training and organizing support for these mobilizations, and with a sort of larger cluster of internationals from many different places who've come here to take part in the actions.
I see. It's been very intense over the last couple of days. Can you tell us some of your... Wow, what was that?
I don't know.
Can you tell us some of your thoughts about what's happened over the last couple of days? Or would you rather keep watching the crowd?
No, I can do both. We've had some very powerful actions over the last few days. On the 10th, there was a march to the fence. At that time, the barrier was closer into the city, and the campesinos and the Black Bloc basically pulled it down and with a lot of help from everybody else and essentially destroyed it, and mm-hmm. that was very powerful. And of course, young Lee, one of the Korean farmers, committed a ritual suicide at the beginning of the action as his protest, sort of the ultimate protest against the WTO. The WTO is killing farmers around the world. When Vandana Shiva spoke at the forum a couple days before that, she was talking about how many farmer suicides they've seen in India because the policies of the WTO basically drive small farmers off their land, make it impossible for them to live or to receive what they need in order to keep farming. And so I think his act was symbolic and really made it real and very vivid for all of us that this isn't just an abstract battle, it's truly about human lives.
I think before anyone comes out on to a scene mm-hmm. like this, that there's some internal justification and some a time you have to take for yourself mm-hmm. to try and justify why you're here. Did you do any of that this morning?
I always do that. I did that weeks ago before I came here to begin with. Yesterday, for me, justified why we were here. A group of about 200 to 300 of us managed to get through all of their security right up to the convention center itself and blockaded the roads there and the entrances for 3.5 hours. And it was really very, very beautiful, very powerful. It was mostly a mixture of internationals and the Mexican students from the universities who've come down here who were sort of the real front lines of the action, who were just so strong and beautiful. And it was completely, at the same time, completely nonviolent and totally disruptive. Very, very powerful act. And we did a spiral dance in the middle of the street. We had a ceremony. We brought in 2 trees. Originally, we were going to plant them, but we just danced around them. We did an ofrenda, which is an altar on the ground of seeds and beans and the food that is sacred to people because it represents life. And in the end, the government didn't want sort of the political fallout of arresting all those students, so they bussed us out. All the students climbed on the top of the buses, and we had this like triumphal procession back to Cancun City, and an incredible victory dance right here, right down the road here in Ground Zero, where the fence went down a couple days before. So it's been an amazing few days. You know, our numbers aren't huge here. A lot of people couldn't come to Cancun City because the distance is great and the expense is great. And many, many people I know in the movement are now very deeply committed to the work they're doing in their home communities. But a lot of us felt it was important to come, that this is the place where you can actually contest the whole system all at once. And we've done some really amazing things here. It's also been really amazing to me, and part of the reason I came is to see campesinos, Mexican students, all these people from different places and different cultures and different organizing styles working together to learn how other groups and cultures organize, and to be able to be part of that. It's a great privilege.
I've read your latest book, Webs of Power, mm-hmm. and I've was interested that you, in the last couple of actions that are this big, there have been affinity groups here. Mm-hmm. Are there affinity groups here today?
Yes, the students and the internationals are organized into affinity groups. And yesterday was very much planned on a basis of affinity groups and spokes councils. And we had a spokes council assembly consensus meeting in the middle of the street, which probably took a good hour of the 3 hours of the blockade just in the decision-making process about whether to go out on the buses or not. And it's been really a beautiful process.
You're a veteran, in a way, of ever since Seattle, of these things. Can you tell me any feelings of how things have evolved? Have you got a sense of how things have changed this time?
I think things have deepened and matured since Seattle. You know, we, as a movement, we've held a lot of very deep tensions around questions like violence and nonviolence, around tactics, around diversity, around how we should and should not organize. And we seem to have really successfully held those tensions and contradictions so that we can mobilize together and work out agreements and also work out respect for different people taking different kinds of actions in different spaces and have great solidarity around that. we've also, I think, been shifting in this mobilization to a focus on what is our vision. Because in some sense, you know, a lot of us feel like the WTO one way or another is already dead, that it's so internally divided, and I think the cracks in the system are coming apart not just because of what we've done here in this week, but because of the movement we've built globally over the last 4 years. And so what we need to shift to is what is our vision. And the Mexican students have been very clear and strong under the influence of Zapatismo, that what this is about is reclaiming space and reclaiming it in a new way and transforming it, creating a different world, a different vision in the moment that we are doing the actions. So again, yesterday on the street, you know, we completely reclaimed that space. The place where Lee died and where the first fence came down now has been transformed into an encampment with an altar for him, with banners, with wreaths, with flowers. We had an amazing celebration there yesterday. It's become like a public gathering plaza instead of just a traffic circle. You know, I think one of the projects that we did, a group from California called the Green Bloc came down that I'm connected to and created a kind of eco-village installation for the encampment of the campesinos, where we demonstrated some of the techniques of permaculture with rain catchment, with a very simple water pump that can lift water up with just a bicycle wheel, with a gray water system to purify the water from hand washing. We did a shower system, and the idea was to have it right there in the encampment, so the encampment itself becomes a model of what we want to see in the world, And also, you know, the campesinos who were camping there were really interested in all of this stuff and this whole understanding, because many of them are really looking for just the, you know, they're the experts on living close to the earth and living with the land and what the land needs and how you live sustainably, and they're always interested in looking for, you know, new ideas and new, you know, one woman came up and was really interested in the pump and was saying they don't have any, you know, running water where she lives. They have to carry it all up in buckets, and a pump is like really expensive, and here's a really simple, cheap solution. You know, so people were sketching things all week. Eric, who was one of the organizers, told me at one point he was washing his hands and a little 5-year-old campesino girl came up to him and explained the entire system to him piece by piece. That's very sweet.
So in a way, you're talking about alternatives as well.
Yeah, we're very much about alternatives, about saying not only is another world possible, but we actually know what it looks like and we know how to build it. And we would like to just get on with that, get rid of the barriers and the fences and the police battles and the organizations like the OMC or the WTO and the World Bank and the IMF and all the rest of them that make these kinds of protests necessary, because we have a lot of work to do. But the positive thing that's come out of all of this protest and all this work, you know, is the relationships that get built across different lines of cultures and people, different political lines. You know, hopefully those are the relationships that we can build on when it comes time to start the healing and the reconstruction.
I usually ask at the end of interviews what kind of message you'd take to the WTO, but I actually think I'll change it a little bit this time. Mm-hmm. For the movement and for everybody here, what kind of message would you like to send out?
What I'd like to say to the movement and to everyone is that this is just a really, really crucial, important moment in human history. And I think all of, probably your Greenpeace listeners are aware of what's happening in the broader environmental sense in the world, the climate change, the incredible level of stress that the life support systems of the earth are under. We don't have a lot of time to turn that around, but I believe we do have the time, and this is it. This is the crossroads, and that means it's a time where everything that anyone does is really, really important. You know, this mobilization wouldn't be happening if it weren't for actually a very few people who took it upon themselves to do the work of making it happen. And we need more people, not just showing up to these things, because we've had more people showing up, you know, through the peace marches and stuff, which is great. But now it's time to start taking the next step and think about what is it you can actually make happen? What is it you can organize? What is it you can mobilize? What is your creative vision? And how do you make it real? And don't let anybody stop you from making it real. You don't need permission from the state. You don't need some authority to tell you. You don't need some certificate of expertise. All you need is the vision and the passion and the will to do it.
Thank you very much, Starhawk.
You're welcome. Thank you.
California author and activist Starhawk, speaking with Danielle Hickey in Cancun, Mexico. The controversy engendered by neoliberal policies is seldom acknowledged by official America, but it is front and center in the public discourse just over the border in Canada. Canada has hosted 3 economic summits in as many years, and opposition to free trade policies has developed across a wide political spectrum. For the remainder of the program, we're going to bring you some Canadian perspectives. Elvira Trulia is in Cancun and spoke with a Canadian attorney who has been using the courts to fight the corporate takeover of Canada's infrastructure.
I'm speaking with Stephen Schreibman, who is a Canadian lawyer working with various civil society organizations. He's been participating in the People's Forum, the Alternative People's Forum, in Cancun, Mexico. Stephen, the privatization of public services is one of the central debates surrounding the WTO talks, and I think the general public has seemed to bought the idea that privatization is inevitable. You've been involved in a lot of cases relating to privatization issues. Can you answer the question, is it actually possible to resist privatization?
Yes. Yes, well, it's certainly possible to resist, and people are certainly engaged in that struggle all over the world, and Canada is no exception in that regard. And we're really facing an unprecedented wave of initiatives to privatize public services. I mean, they usually offered it in the guise of public-private partnerships, which some people refer to as privatization with a pretty face, the P3s. Model is really simply a model for privatization, and we've experienced a great deal of privatization in Canada over the last decade or so, and certainly the privatization of Air Canada has created a situation that many Canadians are familiar with, and not that all of the woes of the airline industry are associated with deregulation and privatization in that sector, but I believe many of them are. But we have had some success in beating back privatization initiatives, and one of perhaps the most celebrated was the defeat of efforts to sell the transmission and much of the electricity distribution system in Ontario. The Tory government in Ontario broke up a public sector monopoly, Ontario Hydro, that had served the people of the province well for almost the last 100 years, since 1907. It's interesting that Ontario Hydro was created as a result of a struggle between small town Ontario and Bay Street that wanted to build a private electricity empire for profit, and communities that wanted a public system that would run on a not-for-profit basis. And it did for a long time until the Tories were elected, and it wasn't until they talked about privatization in their first mandate they really moved forward with it in their second. Then it's a complicated story when you look at the entire privatization scheme for the electricity sector, but one of the key elements of the piece was their effort to sell the basic infrastructure, the wires, the big wires and the small wires, that deliver electricity to every home and hospital and business in the province. QP and other unions and the NDP decided that they were going to make a real fight of that program and initiative, and organized a campaign to educate and inform people about what was going on, because much of it was going on behind the smoke screen of backroom politics, and to inform people about the likely indications of privatization in the electricity sector, which would threaten not only stable prices and increased prices, but also ultimately undermine the reliability of electricity supply in the province. And, there was a public mobilization in resistance to, the privatization, the deregulation of the electricity sector. There was something called the Ontario Electricity Coalition that organized, and they had meetings in dozens of communities across Ontario, raising public awareness and inevitably public concern about the privatization project. At a certain point in December, I think it was believed, 2001, Mike Harris stood up in the legislature. It was the last time the legislature was to sit that year, and as he knew, but we didn't, it was the last time that he would ever appear in the legislature of Ontario, because he planned to retire, and he announced that he would sell Hydro One. This is the most valuable public infrastructure in Ontario, and for that reason really in Canada. It's the second largest electricity grid in North America, and it would have been the largest privatization in Canadian history, over twice the size of the privatization of CN Rail. It was a huge deal. He was going to abandon public ownership of the electricity transmission and distribution system in Ontario. And because people had been involved in the struggle, and gotten me involved for that matter, I had done a trade opinion for the NDP, some of us realized that selling the grid had never been part of the plan. Dismantling Ontario Hydro and deregulating prices had been part of the plan. We didn't like it, and we were campaigning against it, but not selling the grid. And when we looked, we discovered that the province didn't have legal authority, we didn't think, to sell the grid. And after the IPO was issued, and we understood precisely what it was they were planning to do, because they held their cards very close to the vest, the Canadian Union of Public Employees and the Communications, Energy and Paper Workers Union decided, because their members were involved in the campaign, because they had done the education work and the mobilization work, And because the unions understood how important the struggle was, they decided that they would go to court and argue that indeed the sale of the shares of this Crown utility, this public asset, was unlawful or would be unlawful. And we did that. I mean, had the privilege of representing the trade unions. The judge concluded that we were right and that the government didn't have the authority to sell Hydro One. And that precipitated a storm of public controversy and notoriety around the sale, which remained at a high boil for several weeks, not just because of the collapsed plan, this huge enterprise that Bay Street was had already. I mean, I think there was a story in the National Post quoting one of the Bay Street brokers involved, saying, you know, we almost peed our pants, his words, when the premier announced this deal, licking our lips. He didn't say that about all the money we were going to make in this privatization deal. The middleman costs were going to be, by their admission, about $120 million. We suspect probably much higher. But it was a huge blow to the government and to Bay Street, to the privatization industry. And it set in action a chain of events that ultimately led to the firing of the CEO of Hydro One, the resignation of all the members of the board of Hydro One. And it's probably the most glorious example of a privatization project because of its scale, being stopped cold. In that case, because of a legal strategy, but the legal strategy wouldn't have occurred but for the the grassroots mobilization and campaigning and the commitment by the NDP. They deserve credit for this one, certainly, in taking this struggle on and not letting go of it.
That was an example of how, basically, working within the legal system, you were able to win the case. Do you have any examples of how grassroots mobilization could make an impact?
Well, I think that there are lots of examples there as well where, you know, people have mobilized and discouraged municipal governments or hospitals or school boards from pursuing privatization projects. One of the other fights that I was involved in involved a bit of a legal strategy, but not the courts, had to do with the efforts by the Greater Vancouver Regional District, I'll call them GVRD for short, to enter into a private partnership with one of the big conglomerates. Vivendi was one of the companies bidding to build a water filtration plant in the GVRD in the Greater Vancouver Regional District. Would have been the largest water filtration plant in North America. There had been a lot of work in Vancouver, not just to fight with privatization, but to raise awareness about international investment treaties and international services agreement. There was a lot of public mobilization in Vancouver and in British Columbia. You know, one measure of that is the Council of Canadians, you know, is an interesting, probably good measure of the degree to which people are kind of engaged in and around some of these issues, how active the council is and how many chapters. I think half the chapters in Canada are in BC. And it's just that people tend to think of that as forming a local chapter of the Council of Canadians is a good way to express their concerns about privatization or, you know, the national institutions, cultural and otherwise, like healthcare, that are such an important part of the fabric. They'd done a lot of work and they'd done a lot of educating of municipal councillors. They'd gone to council and asked council to pass resolutions opposing the MAI, the Multilateral Agreement on Investment, and opposing the GATS, the General Agreement on Trade and Services. So they'd done a lot of work educating and informing, not just the community, but also municipal officials. Well, when this privatization project came down the pipe, QP, again a union, asked me to do an opinion looking at the implications of a privatization project given Canada's obligations under the investment provisions of NAFTA, which entitle foreign investors to sue you directly if they argue that you're in breach of any of your obligations to foreign investors under that trade agreement, that trade treaty. And, so we were able to demonstrate that a municipal politician thinking about the deal might think of it in terms of it being a contract with a supplier, you know, a large conglomerate to build and own and operate a water filtration plant, that contract was actually a foreign investment agreement in the nomenclature of NAFTA, even though they didn't know it. The corporations understood this well enough because they helped write these international treaties that transformed a whole array of domestic policy and legislative and contractual initiatives into matters that were the subject of international trade disciplines. And so, I mean, we could say, well, even though it's a contract to you, it's an international investment to them. And even though you think if there are problems, you may resolve them or you, recourse would be had to provincial courts under the terms of this treaty, they go to international tribunals. And what made the argument so persuasive and compelling is that the very companies that were involved in bidding on the project in the GVRD, or some of them, had actually invoked the provisions of international investment treaties, virtually identical to the ones in NAFTA, to go after governments when privatization deals failed. I mean, the most well-known example is Bechtel going after Bolivia when a project to privatize water services in Cochabamba, Bolivia, failed dismally. But there were other examples. Vivendi had sued Argentina around the privatization of sewage and water services in a particular province. And, you know, and what was interesting about that case, too, was that they had entered into a contract with Argentina. And the contract said, if there are disputes that arise under this privatization deal, they'll be resolved in our courts and only in our courts. And Vivendi ignored the provision of the contract and invoked an investment treaty to have the dispute resolved between it by a totally secretive international tribunal. And so we were able to bring those cases forward. And the GVRD said, having considering all of this, that we've decided to cancel our plans. They were well along. They'd already issued the RFP. They had the bids in. We're not going to privatize this facility for two reasons. We're concerned about our exposure to international investment and trade challenges, and we've been impressed by the public opposition to this project. So there you have it. It was another very, very significant, very substantial victory. Public mobilization, education, all that hard slogging work people often who are, do it, you know, wonder, well, you know, what difference is it going to make? Who's really listening to us? Well, you know, in both of the examples that I've given you, the hydro case in Ontario and in BC, none of those projects would have proceeded but for public resistance. And even if you get lawyers involved at some point who may put something kind of sexy on the table, like a legal opinion or a court challenge, that won't happen unless there's a broad base of support resisting the privatization project. And I think that's where the credit for those victories really properly lies. It's important to appreciate that, you know, the successful resistance to privatization projects isn't just a luxury that, you know, people can afford in developed countries, but often it's a necessity and even a matter of life and death for people in developing countries, and they've had success as well. I mean, the two examples that I briefly referred to, Bolivia, clearly, I mean, the cancellation of that privatization project was followed a popular uprising in Cochabamba. I mean, those people were impoverished and poor. In fact, one of the issues for them was that water that belonged to them and their communities and had for ever was now owned by Bechtel, that was charging them a fee for drawing water from the local well. And not only was that outrageous, but the fee itself, even though it might be modest by our terms, represented a very, very substantial portion of the disposable income of people, many, many people who were living on very, very little. And so they rose up and in a very determined way, and there were massive protests, and it was only after that determined effort that the government decided to abandon the project, and now they're being sued under an investment treaty. I don't know the story as well in Argentina, but the project collapsed because of public resistance and because people demanded on the company meeting quality objectives and so on and so forth. And you know, when again resistance was the undoing, even after the fact of the privatization deal, I don't know how wealthy or poor those particular communities were in that province of Argentina, but I know there's been a lot of resistance and struggle in South Africa, and people all around the world, I think, are fighting this struggle, often against their own, or not often, but you know, too often against their own corrupt local administrations. So it's harder, I think, for them. But often the stakes are higher, and so high that people will summon the courage to put their bodies certainly on the line and making it clear that this is not an acceptable solution.
How will the proposed WTO GATS, General Agreement on Trade Services, affect government's ability to protect public services?
The answer is that it's going to make it more difficult, because the trade rules basically codify rules that discourage the policies, the subsidies, the programs, the regulatory initiatives that governments rely upon either to deliver services themselves or to maintain public sector monopolies in areas of healthcare and education and electricity and water sewer services. Really, you know, all of those service areas where basically the object of the exercise is to provide universal service to people regardless of their ability to pay. And so the rules discourage those they discourage governments maintaining public services because the rules basically embrace the free market model that would reduce the role of government in every way that is conceivable. And so those rules will be invoked by foreign corporations and domestic corporations and by governments that favor the neoliberal model to either justify initiatives to abandon public services or to discourage efforts to defend them, or to prevent governments from retreating from privatization initiatives that turn out to be disastrous, as they often do, because the whole thrust of the trade framework is to lock in neoliberal reforms, often described as a ratcheting effect, where reform is possible, but only in the direction of liberalization. And once you privatize or liberalize or deregulate, it's impossible to retreat, while at the same time making it difficult to impossible for governments to establish new measures of regulation or to establish public services like auto insurance, for example, in areas where those public services don't exist. We say to governments, certainly at the provincial and local level, to act, notwithstanding the threat of trade sanctions. Sometimes those risks are overstated. Sometimes they're not going to arise because there isn't a corporation in a position that allows it the influence to persuade another government to challenge Canada directly under WTO rules, or there isn't enough foreign investment to create a sufficient incentive for any foreign investor to invoke their unilateral rights to enforce the investment provisions of NAFTA. And so we don't want concern about international trade disciplines to be a chill on governments who are resisting privatization initiatives, but it's a real worry. And the more develop that framework, the more corrosive the influence is going to be in terms of the policy framework and the regulatory framework necessary to sustain public sector services.
You were talking earlier today about whether or not it is possible to have international trade rules that promote human rights as opposed to just, you know, further liberalization. Do you think it is possible to reform the WTO?
Well, I mean, in some areas, perhaps it may be, but I don't think that there's any justification for international services disciplines, which, for people who are familiar with trade law, might seem like a bit of a radical notion. I'm really talking about blowing up the GATS, I suppose. The services agreement isn't about international trade. I mean, that's very clear. Trade use rules used to be about trade, the trade of goods across international boundaries. Now they're about domestic policy and law, even the most local level. And that's what the services agreement is about. It's about the use of international sanction to enforce a neoliberal model imposed on domestic policy and law. You know, the example that I gave you about the GVRD and water services, well, that's a local government entering into a contract with the corporation to provide local services. What does that have to do with international trade? And why would Canada cede sovereignty? In other words, the right of a local government to listen to its own constituents with respect to how they would like services, vital services in this case, water services, provided to them. What conceivable justification is there for international disciplines for that purpose? There isn't any rational public policy justification whatsoever. We may need international rules to deal with climate change. In fact, we do. We do need international rules, and we need to strengthen them to deal with human rights abuses. We do need some international rules that concern the trade in goods, particularly when it's unjust and unfair. But we don't need international rules on investment or services, unless you happen to be a transnational corporation that doesn't like the idea of any domestic control on your right to invest in a particular community or society. And when you do invest, any government control of how you carry out business. I mean, that's the only justification for these rules. They were established without anybody understanding their import, other than a handful of officials in the trade bureaucracies of a particular government. Believe me, as a lawyer working on public policy issues, I know lots of people in the public service, and I know lots of politicians. They don't understand the GATS framework. They clearly do not understand its implications. They did not give informed consent, or Canada really a mandate to negotiate these agreements. Even the past director of the WTO, Ruggiero, conceded in a speech he made that the implications of the GATS, which he described properly as an investment treaty, were much more profound than either people in the public sector or the private sector yet understood. I think it's a candid and very accurate assessment. It has no democratic, there was no democratic mandate for it. It has no legitimacy in my view. There's no public policy justification, either domestic or international, for it. It's an unneeded, unnecessary, destructive constraint on sovereignty. There will be a huge cost to pay in terms of the weakening of the democratic fabric of societies. And it needs to be abandoned because its rules are fundamentally unjust and unsustainable. Now, to some people that seems like a very radical prescription, but if you understand that this is a project that is only now in its eighth year, that hasn't yet been implemented, that people are now only beginning to understand the implications of which, and which really isn't durable, it's not that difficult to think forward a little to a time when there'll be a much broader understanding about the unsustainability of this regime and its corrosive influences, and it will be undone. Whether or not there's some reforms that may be made along the way in order to resist the process of a more radical reform or to address some of the more egregious abuses, I don't know. But I'm convinced that this is not a regime that that will endure. So I think that's the answer I would give to the question of whether or not it ultimately can be reformed. We don't need international disciplines on services.
Stephen Strybman speaking with Elvira Trulia in Cancun earlier this week. Other opponents see the WTO as part of a larger problem, that of capitalism in general. Stefan Christoph of CKUT Radio in Montreal spoke with Aziz Chaudhry of the Popular Mobilization Against the WTO in Montreal and Tom Hazen, an organizer with the Mexico Solidarity Network. Both are currently in Cancun.
Aziz, in the resistance that we're seeing to the World Trade Organization ministerial, but more generally to the WTO throughout the world by many communities, especially in the Global South, what is your view in terms of alternatives to this, what is being called neoliberal model of economics and trade? Are these communities, from what you can sense, expressing alternative models of trade and alternative models of maintaining communities around agriculture, but also more broadly?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think one of the big lies of the neoliberal model is that there is no alternative. I mean, we had that from Maggie Thatcher back in the 1980s, and that sort of gets repeated time and time again. And I mean, here in the Americas, it's very clear that in spite of the best efforts of colonial regimes, whether they're, the sort of legacy of the Spanish colonialism or the kinds of colonialism, the sensitive New Age colonialism, so-called, that we have here in Canada, that Indigenous peoples throughout this region, throughout this hemisphere and throughout the world have always managed to maintain alternative forms of society and alternative ways of running economies, which aren't necessarily about the monetary economy at all. And in some ways, I think you can see One of the reasons why I think Indigenous peoples are considered to be such a threat, such a problem by the sort of the free marketeers is because they do actually seriously challenge the whole fundamental worldview on which the WTO, the neoliberalism, corporate capitalism, call it what you will, is based. And so rather than sort of advocating for a big, grand, one-size-fits-all alternative to neoliberal globalisation, I'd say that I think that the struggles and the resistance that are going on right now to these forms of injustice, economic and social and ecological injustice, that institutions like the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund and so on, perpetrate and make worse, I think that out of that resistance, is coming new forms of organising societies. And I think we've often been a bit conned into thinking, and I think some NGOs buy into this a little bit too, that, you know, we need to come up with this sort of grand scheme of saying, you know, this is the alternative. And in reality, I think what's going to work for, you know, campesino communities in parts of, say, Chiapas is not going to work necessarily in parts of the Pacific or the Philippines or India, but there may well be very similar common themes and common values that are being expressed by people who actually see there to being much more to the world than a view that is based on commodification, capitalism, and colonialism.
Now, Tom, you're in Cancun right now. You mentioned that the city is completely militarized. Now, let's just look back for a second at the last WTO ministerial meetings, which took place in 2001 in Qatar. Now, the United States was riding high, I suppose, in world opinion. After the attacks on September 11th, there wasn't as much of an ability within institutions like the WTO to critique the United States policies within the organizing at the WTO. What's your sense now? The city, Cancun, is militarized. The United States is being heavily critiqued for its bombing of Afghanistan, of Iraq, its continued occupation of both of those countries. So maybe can you expand on these kind of dynamics within the WTO, the United States relationship to the rest of the world, and also the WTO and militarization and how you feel the two of these things are linked?
Well, there's every indication that these WTO meetings are going to be a failure. And they're going to be a failure largely because northern nations, led by the United States, have a particular set of agendas in these meetings that don't match the needs of southern nations. And the two haven't been able to see eye to eye. And I think as a result of the sort of rampant imperialism on the part of the United States and the undemocratic nature of world political decisions that the United States has made, for example, the invasion of Iraq in contradiction to what the United Nations was saying, for example, it's emboldened southern nations to take on the United States agenda. And so we're seeing a whole series of discussions that are going on that I don't think we're... agriculture, I don't... There's a divide that is not going to be... It can't be... There's no middle ground in this divide. Discussions around tariffs. The United States and other northern nations want to keep tariffs on things that are produced in the South, for example, textiles and steel products. The southern nations want to maintain tariffs on things like high technology and intellectual property, for example, music, because it destroys national industries. The northern nations want to impose or don't want to allow developing nations to use generic drugs to fight things like AIDS. Southern nations, of course, in particular Brazil, has had a very good track record using generic drugs to fight AIDS. So you can just go right down the list, and there's a series of contradictions, and it looks like there isn't going to be any serious agreements on any of these issues.
Aziz Chaudhry, there has been some links developed between the movement which we saw develop this last year, of course expanding on a historical movement against war, links between the anti-war movement and the movements which are opposing institutions like the WTO. Can you expand on how you feel, say, opposing the invasion in Iraq and imposing the World Trade Organization mini-ministerial meetings? How are these two fabrics linked, neoliberal economics and militarization?
Yeah, well, I think they're two sides of the same coin, Stefan. And Central America is a classic example where, you know, corporate interests, globalization, militarization all go together. If you look at Plan Colombia, you can see, you know, the so-called war on drugs is essentially linked very closely to U.S. corporate interests, such as Occidental Petroleum, that essentially through Plan Colombia gets $98 million U.S. dollars as sort of a corporate welfare slash, you know, security to fund military in Colombia to look after their pipeline. If you look at the players that are involved in the so-called reconstruction of Iraq, and you look at some of the main pushes in the corporate world, pushing, say, water privatization, you've got Bechtel, you've got Dan Amstutz, who is a former vice president of Cargill, which I think was one of the corporations which Tom mentioned earlier, a very big U.S. transnational corporation, who was also a former negotiator for the U.S. on agriculture in the Uruguay round of the GATT talks, which set up the World Trade Organization in the late 80s. And it's interesting to see some of the stuff that's been going on in the Bay Area in the States. The Direct Action to Stop the War people have done quite an impressive job of linking the sort of the war and the corporate globalization stuff together and saying, well, isn't it interesting that you've got this seamless sort of linkage between these sort of companies that are pushing things like privatization of water and so on, such as Bechtel, and are the same people that are in Iraq and pushing for contracts through their mates, through the sort of whole cozy revolving door system between the U.S. administration and the corporate world in the States. Over the last 20 years, where there have been so-called, you know, IMF riots in countries in the South, and where there have been, you know, whether it's Seattle or Genoa, or whether it's the four young men that were shot dead in Papua New Guinea just before Genoa, you know, standing up against World Bank imposed privatization programs. And I think some of the biggest defense contractors in the world, the likes of Boeing, Lockheed Martin, all of those corporations, see the neoliberal agenda as a way to make more money. And of course, that goes hand in hand too with the sort of the war profiteering.
That was Stefan Christoph of CKUT Radio in Montreal speaking with Aziz Chowdhury of the Popular Mobilization Against the WTO and Tom Hazen, an organizer with the Mexico Solidarity Network. This coming weekend, September 19th through 21st, Ithaca will hold a peace celebration to welcome Father Daniel Berrigan. The weekend of festivities entitled Celebrating Peace Activism kicks off next Friday, the 19th, with a poetry reading by activist poets at the First Baptist Church in Ithaca at 7 p.m. On Saturday at Cornell University, the video This Is What Democracy Looks Like will be shown at 11:30 in Uris Hall, followed at 1 p.m. by a roundtable discussion. A festival of music and performance featuring Michelle Schacht and Vermont's Bread and Puppet Theater will take place on Cornell's Arts Quad from 2:30 to 7 p.m. Father Daniel Berrigan will give a public address in Barnes Hall Saturday night at 7:30 p.m. and a sermon the following morning, Sunday, at Sage Chapel at 11 a.m. For more information, contact the Center for Religion, Ethics, and Social Policy at 607-255-5027. That's 607-255-5027. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. you can contact us through our website at unwelcomeguests.org. It's